church that's liable to trigger the other circuit. I'm happy to be here, and I thank the Society for inviting me, and I hope that all of you will accept this paper in the spirit that it's offered. It's offered as a beginning of ideas of things that need to be explored in the relationship of gender to the building of, or the construction of, what I'm calling, because of my discomfort with the term, the Black Church, when it comes to religion, church, and its boundaries, calling the Afro-Christian religious tradition for the purposes of this paper. Writing in a church history commemorating the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Church of God in Christ, Bishop Osro T. Jones observed, quote, "The proper place of women in the church is an age-old debate, and from all appearances, it seems that it perhaps would be an eternal one, for most mortals at least. This is because too often humanity has looked to the misty heights of theory rather than among the lowly foothills of practice and necessary human service." Bishop Jones then argued that Christianity addressed the problems of the status of women more dramatically and positively than any other religion by insisting that they are, and I quote Bishop Jones, "persons for whom Christ died." Reflecting on Galatians 3:28, Jones wrote, "But lest we forget, this has been possible only because Christianity has defined women to be persons. In so doing, Christianity has insisted that women are not commodities or an inferior breed or something like factory rejects of the human race, conceptions which held and hold sway wherever humanity has lived in the era of BC, before Christ. For persons for whom Christ died, any incidental physical condition is no longer a barrier to freedom or dignity or value as a person, whether that physical be social distinction, be race, Jew or Gentile, class, bond or free, or sex, male or female. They all share one spiritual destiny and nature and value in Christ. They all are fellow heirs of the promise in Christ." This Black man's statement, written at the height of an era which came to be identified with the feminine mystique, the statement was written no later than 1957, is important. The type of debate which Bishop Jones was conscious was not clear in his essay. However, Jones argued that the overwhelming response of women to Christianity was, quote, "grateful acknowledgement of what Christ has done." He then advanced a rhetorical but important question. Indeed, who would deny that largely by their hands and feet and service has the kingdom of our Lord moved forward? Because of the purpose of his essay, a tribute to the Women's Department of the Church of God in Christ, one can discern that Jones was supportive of the women's right to an autonomous women's convention under the leadership of Mother Lillian Brooks Coffey, quote, "the guiding spirit and leader of this momentous army of the church." Since oral tradition supports a militance by Mother Coffey of almost legendary proportions, one informant told me she almost split the church, and since she was also a feminist and an energetic supporter of the Black Women's Club movement, one can surmise that Jones' statement of personhood represented a central confession concerning the importance of gender in the Afro-Christian tradition and the centrality of women to its growth, spread, and development. This paper explores the way in which women and women's experience have been essential resources for the construction of tradition and traditional religious knowledge. Four pillars of Afro-Christian religious tradition are discussed: preaching, praying, singing, and testifying. While there are methodological problems associated with the study of preaching, prayer, and testimony, a reasonably proficient experience in the world of Black religion should contribute to a well-developed ear for the pertinent elements of the tradition. And after I finished this draft and I was reflecting on it, I thought about the We always talk about literary criticism in reference to religious experience, but perhaps the models of music appreciation might also be helpful for surveying the entire tradition. I don't know, but it's something to think about. Several questions arise when we view the relationship of black women to their religion. Do the oral and written traditions of the black church speak about women's experience? Are women and women's experience visible within the traditions and rituals? Has the subordination of women within most, but not all, black churches been reflected in their role in the fashioning and maintaining of these pillars of tradition? Have black women been silenced or silent about their positions in the church? If black women have been persistent and even enterprising agents of religious tradition, and if issues of gender are apprehended by the tradition, and this paper suggests that such is the case, then precisely what roles do women perform? What is the sociological importance of women to the entire black religious enterprise? Has black women's historical role been marginal and trivial, or has it been central and vital? What, if any, relationship exists between the importance of black women to the social construction of black religious knowledge and the ambivalent response of black women to white feminist movements and those issues, for instance, inclusive language, central to the white feminist critique of religion? Now, let me note here that this paper doesn't claim to answer all of these questions, but they are questions that we should keep in mind. Let me note here that I use the phrase Afro-Christian tradition in place of the usual black church, but not consistently, because of the plurality of experience encompassed by this discussion. Not only are we speaking of many congregations, denominations, and settings, but whenever we address the issue of preaching, praying, singing, and testifying, we are focusing on phenomena that extend far beyond the walls of black churches and that are carried and passed along through the interactional processes that constitute tradition. What is handed down, defended, protected, popularized, and occasionally prostituted is something that was essentially forged during slavery in a variety of settings and is greater than the institutional boundaries that the term church implies. Additionally, it is essential to recognize in our conceptual language that our ancestors constructed a complex and dynamic tradition, not only from the materials provided by the missionaries and other Europeans they confronted in the nighttime of slavery, but also from the cultural imaginations of their African background that viewed women as essential to cultural and religious practice. We should not forget that many slaves did not forget about the women priests and queen mothers in their home societies. This paper does not claim to be a complete study of the problem of gender in these pillars of the Afro-Christian religious tradition, nor does it intend to answer all the questions such an investigation would generate. My aim is to chart new pathways in suggesting directions for sociological research on the black religious experience. Let me just briefly comment on the problem of feminism and social knowledge and how we locate the social problem. Contemporary sociological thinking about women has moved beyond the problem of social roles and comprises several interrelated problems focusing on social institutions, culture, social inequality, and the sociology of knowledge. Both sociological analysis and the feminist critique of culture recognize the importance of the production of society's knowledge. Multitudes of cultural materials carry explicit and implicit suggestions regarding the appropriate social roles for women and men. In her examination of sexism in the social construction of knowledge, Margaret Anderson argues, and I quote, "The ideas about women and men that these cultural objects portray greatly influence our thinking about gender roles in society. As images, they convey an impression about the proper role of women, their sexual identity, and their self-consciousness. The ideas we hold about women and men, whether overtly sexist or more subtle in their expression, create social definitions that we use to understand ourselves and the society we live in. The images of women projected by the media, images which distinguish between black and white women, reinforce a cultural vision of women that is for white women subordinating, and for black women additionally humiliating for the women as well as the men. The explanation for such sexism and sexist racism or racist sexism may be attributed to simple value reflection, to conscious role modeling, to organizational gender inequality, or to prevalent patriarchal interests within capitalism. And I should note here, we have to keep in mind that there is no racial stereotype or racist stereotype in this society that does not have a specific gender application. If you think of all the different stereotypes they have of black people, they also have a specific gender application. And I think that's important. Anderson moves beyond these explanations to insist that the explanatory key to the problem of sexism and the social construction of knowledge is the exclusion of women from the pursuit of and production of knowledge. Isolation, exclusion, and tokenism are central characteristics of institutions such as academia, and these social realities operate to keep women not only from contributing to the apprehension and interpretation of cultural experience, but also from a certain attachment to oppressive institutions. It is their stranger status, where the outsider is both involved with and indifferent to the shared perspectives of the group as a whole. While their exclusion, isolation, and detachment prevent women from transforming patriarchy, Anderson notes that their detachment creates critical distance so that what is taken for granted by group members may be held in doubt by insiders. Many of you are familiar with Hegel's analysis of the perspective of the slave, and Anderson borrows this to discuss the perspective of women. And she goes on to say that the experience of women like that of the slave has been invisible. Women inhabit the same world as men. In fact, women's labor shapes men's experience in the world. Women's labor makes the male models of operation detached and rational possible, yet it remains invisible to men as the dominant class. While the roots of white women's social problem with contemporary patriarchy can be compared with the experience of the slave, it is not the experience of the slave. The hints of black women's visibility in the world of black men can be found in the slave narratives, where the accounts of women's abuse through rape and physical punishment are often vividly documented by men. Furthermore, as early as 1869, black men were conscious of the errors of white men in their view of women. According to Linda Perkins, in her analysis of racial uplift in black women's education in the 19th century, and I quote, "Cooperative efforts between black females and males were prevalent in the 19th century community. Quote, since liberation of the race was the immediate goal of blacks, and the men attached great importance to the female's role in this effort." And then Perkins, providing an example of this black male perspective, writes, "While sexism was not completely absent from the black community, black men became some of the earliest advocates of women's rights. In 1869, when black men formed the Colored National Labor Union, they admitted black women and elected a female to the executive committee of the group. The body voted to uphold equal rights for women and further stated that they were, quote, profiting by the mistakes heretofore made by our white fellow citizens in omitting women. For the slaves and freed people of the 19th century, their consciousness was informed by the heroic status of several black women. Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman were two women who were particularly prominent, and their roles within the community raised questions about every assumption that was generated about the capabilities of women. Paula Giddings has demonstrated that the historical separation in legal tradition between, quote unquote, incorrupt women who were white and imported to be wives and slave women who were black and imported to be beasts of burden created an historical centrality of women to the fate and future of black people as a self-conscious community." Let us talk a little bit about the problem of gender and these pillars, as I've called them, these pillars of the Afro-Christian tradition. Any interpretation of the Afro-Christian tradition must take into account the centrality of the English Bible to that tradition. The African imagination, in its criticism of white oppression, valued the vivid depictions of liberation within the Old Testament and connected immediately the gospel evangelist's appropriation of that material. The Afro-American religious imagination is a biblical imagination. The generations of black Christians who endured slavery, Reconstruction, Jim and Jane Crow, urban migration, and the civil rights eras were women and men who constructed and fashioned their songs, prayers, testimonies, and sermons using the English, that is, King James Bible, as a resource for the interpretation of past and present sequences of events and for the envisioning of futures and strategies to achieve those futures. The popular witticism that states that black people and preachers do religion with the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other represents a contemporary perspective on this historically larger practice. Indeed, the title of Zora Neale Hurston's great work, Their Eyes Were Watching God, captures the interpretative principle that governed the everyday life and wisdom of black people as they lived their lives in the segregated South. If one adopts the metaphor of darkness for the overwhelming facts of racial oppression, then Hurston's observation, quote, they seemed to be staring at the dark, but their eyes were watching God, end quote, underscores the fact that the Afro-American cultural and political imagination is at its foundations a theological imagination. And the most important critical tool black people have used after reflection on their own experience has been that of the Bible. All four of the pillars of Afro-Christian tradition, sermons, prayers, songs, and testimonies, have utilized the biblical text as a mediator between individual experience and the community. Since slave owners attempted to appropriate the Bible for ideological purposes, black people made it their business to de-ideologize the text. Anyone who could read the text was valuable to the community, and the learning ethic, quote, each one teach one, was a reality in slave communities. And I found very valuable Mamie Garvin Field's oral history called Lemon Swamp and Other Places, a Carolina memoir, where this woman who is now, she was born in 1880, I believe, 1888, and she and her sociologist granddaughter did this volume, and she talks about the learning process in the slave community and how her family came to be part of the educated elite in the Carolinas, where she had a grandfather who was trained to read, and he taught all of his brothers and sisters, and they taught everybody in the quarters, and they actually read Greek and Hebrew. So this is an important idea about how we utilized that leadership back then. The early recruitment of women as educators of the race helped to establish the tradition of their inclusion among the ranks of educators. Later, those educators comprised both preachers and teachers, mostly women, but some men, who represented the earliest free leadership class. The educational skills of black women led to their access to leadership through the route of business success and enterprise. Carter Woodson argued that the faith of black washerwomen also fostered social and economic development within the race. All of this activity took place in the context of the religious tradition. Reading meant reading the Bible. And most black leaders of the time have left some kind of record that indicates the biblical text mediated their injunctions to the race. The first, Nanny Helen Burroughs, With All Thy Getting, Get Wisdom, her famous essay, is just one such example. The first woman of any race to give a formal public lecture in the United States, who was black, justified her appearance on the basis of biblical argument. Maria Stewart, in fact, appealed to the role of women in the Bible as carriers of the good news as justification. So we have a number of descriptions that tell us women were doing things. Often, since the issues of social change were theological and theological concerns focused on social change, black women participated in religious discourse even in settings where their right to preach was not affirmed. Often they could only be teachers. Lucy Campbell's hymn, Something Within, acknowledged the extent of the religious participation of these teachers writing, and you're familiar with this, preachers and teachers would make their appeal, fighting as soldiers on great battlefields, when to their pleadings my poor heart did yield, all I could say, there is something within. Black women emerged as troublers within and beyond the black experience. Sojourner Truth chiding Frederick Douglass, is God dead? By World War I, black women were performing roles central to the growth and development of black churches. As missionaries, they led devotions and preached women's days. As evangelists within the sanctified church, the black-founded holiness and Pentecostal denominations and congregations, they preached revivals and, quote-unquote, dug-out churches. Occasionally, as with the Mount Sinai Holy Church of America and with the House of God, which is the Church of the Living God, the Pillar and Ground of the Truth, Incorporated, black women founded new, albeit small, denominations. Sometimes in such churches as the Fire-Baptized Holiness Church of God of the Americas and the Church of the Living God Christian Workers for Fellowship, women were able to share more or less equally in gospel labors and pastored churches. More often, women were forced simply to build strong women's departments where they built an infrastructure that was critical to church growth and survival. Elsewhere, I've argued that the growth and development of various sanctified churches organized around charismatic male founders, their survival at the same level and growth depended on how strong those women's departments were, but that's another paper. Varying degrees of subordination and subservience were evident, but never silence, isolation, or exclusion. Not only did black church women fashion important and necessary roles for themselves, they also had a powerful effect on religious discourse. Let us look at the problem of these specific pillars, and just briefly, I'm going to summarize some of this. The first tradition that we should consider is black preaching. The tradition for which the black church itself is noted is its preaching tradition. Irrespective of the most abject burdens of racial oppression, white people have recognized the special talent of black preachers. Bad preaching represents the incarnation of the unforgivable sin in black congregations. Preaching is the most masculine tradition of the black church. Yet, when one listens to its most popular and publicly accessible expressions, and by popular and publicly accessible, I mean sermons available on record. This obviously limits the pool, but it's helpful. They're a methodological problem. Yet when one listens to its most popular and publicly accessible expressions, the preaching tradition reflects the centrality of women to the evolution of religious tradition. Black preaching, even in its most androcentric, masculinist, and sexist expressions, is forced to make some reasonable connection with the visible representatives of the community, mostly women. The style of black preaching is such that it is dependent upon its connections with the congregation's experience and upon the community's visible assent to the proclamation. The question, will it preach, is not simply one of form and exegesis, but it is also one of community connectedness. A question of connectedness is answered most efficiently by using the community's canon as it is presented through prayer, testimony, and song as a resource for sermon preparation. These other pillars of tradition persistently inject a leitmotif of inclusiveness into the sermon process. The prayer tradition often frames the preaching event and provides a general charge for the preacher. James Weldon Johnson noted when he observed black preachers who inspired his work, God's Trombones, they were often preceded by a special prayer, and that prayer, Johnson observed, was often delivered by a woman. And the music tradition is also a vital resource for the black preaching tradition. Music functions in several ways within the context of black preaching. Like prayer, it can often frame the preaching event, and in some churches, the traditional pre-sermon prayer has been replaced by the pre-sermon solo. Like the prayer, the function of the song is to provide a pathway for the Spirit, thus actualizing the belief that, quote, the Spirit comes on the wings of a song. Since the restriction of women in the black music tradition is unheard of, the church soloist is often she. The music tradition is also a resource for preaching in that song lyrics are used to drive home the points of sermon. It is the song tradition that often fixes important theological and biblical images in the community's mind. Ideas about God and about Jesus are often carried in very familiar terms by song lyrics. Again, the testimony tradition is an invaluable resource for the black sermon. Not only do examples of church members' testimonies provide cogent sermon illustrations, but such testimonies may also allow the preacher to connect the situation of a biblical character with contemporary problems and experiences. Testimonies provide believable examples of faith that may motivate others to try a particular strategy for confronting and coping with problems. Overwhelmingly, it is women who provide the bulk of the testimony from which preachers are able to draw illustrations. It is the value of testimony as a resource for preaching that increases the significance of women in the shaping of Afro-Christian tradition. The appropriation of their testimonies for sermon illustrations is quite common. The late Reverend Dr. Clarence LeVaughn Franklin serves as an important paradigm for the appropriation of women's testimony for biblical preaching. Not only is he important because of his classic style, but his influence on Afro-Christian tradition is wide-ranging both within his denomination and beyond. Trying to illustrate the importance of steadfast hope, Reverend Franklin used the testimony of two women who sent their sons off to war. One of the mothers had five sons, all of whom she accompanied to the train station. In her testimony, the first mother claimed to have asked the Lord, quote, if it be his will, to bring all of my sons home safely. Franklin claimed that she testified, quote, the Lord heard my cry and brought her sons safely back home. The second woman, who had three sons, prayed the same prayer and lost all of her sons. Yet she got up to thank the Lord, to, quote, thank the Lord also because he gave me the strength to get through my situation and because the Lord is still watching over, opening doors and making a way for me, and therefore, the point of the sermon, nothing shall separate me from the love of God. The manner in which Franklin and many other preachers use such testimony is instructive for our understanding of the dynamics of gender in black churches. First of all, Franklin had just been talking about Job previously. He used the testimony of the women to connect the problem of Job with the problem of contemporary experience. And I've seen other preachers do that very effectively. One young seminarian who preached at our church used Job and then used examples of when, for instance, mothers try to raise a daughter. He just went through all of these women's problems, and he couldn't get out of the pulpit afterwards. And he was only about 5 feet tall, and these great big women just, I mean, they practically lifted him up and carried him around the church afterwards. So he really connected with their experience in the same way that Franklin does in the record. Beyond that, he transferred a biblical story centered on male experience to the experience of contemporary women. Secondly, Franklin and others often locate the problem of black suffering through the direct or indirect use of women's discourse and testimony to the actual experience of suffering shared by black women. In other words, by reflecting women's testimony back to the community by means of the sermon, the black preacher affirms for black women that they have suffered, and unreasonably so. Finally, the black preacher not only contextualizes black women's suffering with reference to a document and canon that focuses largely on males, but the black preacher transfers the entire text as an appropriate possession for black women and their religious experience. In other words, an essential leitmotif of inclusion is sounded such that women are encouraged to use the Bible as a resource for their own spirituality. Unless one understands the active role of black women as the community to which the preacher is connected and the centrality of a shared understanding of the biblical text, one cannot begin to interpret the tenacity with which black women cling to the King James Version of the English Bible. Those women who speak up quite loudly. By the missionaries. The missionaries are, for the most part, women, and they teach this Bible study manual. And the Bible study manual emphasizes the details of the translation process of the King James Version so that the laity is encouraged to recognize they possess a translation of the Bible and not the Bible. And it's very interesting the details that it goes into in teaching that. In spite of the overwhelmingly male character of black preaching, these men do manage to include women in their sermons in other ways. One of these strategies is to draw illustrations from women biblical characters and to place in the mouths of these biblical women the ordinary discourse that is recognizable as black women's. In listening, I've been listening to C.L. Franklin's sermons for the purpose of this paper for quite some time, and he over and over again uses the mother of James and John. She just shows up repeatedly in his sermons. Finally, black male preachers occasionally provide androgynous or feminine imagery in the context of a sermon. Some of them are masters of what I would call the androgynous sermon. Such a sermon is one that is grounded in imagery of God that transcends particularly male or female attributes and manages occasionally to dispense with human reference altogether. One sermon I heard was called Who? It was preached by an elderly Boston preacher who is notorious, for his refusal to approve of women preachers. He won't let women walk in his pulpit at all. I don't even think he lets them clean it. He simply does not believe in them and will not allow them in his pulpit. At a regional convention, however, he preached his sermon as an answer to the question, which he happened to ponder in his study one day when he was looking out his window and said, "Who did all this?" The entire sermon was a long epic poem about who. It was just one chain of clauses about who and God's activity, who, and it focused entirely on God's biblical activity without referring to God with a personal pronoun. The person I was sitting next to, and he and I were listening to it, and I said, "Am I hearing things?" He said, "No, you're not hearing things." And we were just amazed at this sermon, and it's one of those accidents, and it was not taped or anything, but God remained who for the entire sermon. Other preachers also transcend human attributes in a similar manner and in an inspired concluding either coda, otherwise known as hoop, at the end of the sermon. If they do not transcend human attributes, they often imply the motherly nature of him. One of the most widely used examples of this tendency to emphasize God as mother in black preaching is Franklin's sermon, "The Eagle Stirreth Her Nest." Within that sermon, Franklin goes to great lengths to stress that the Bible speaks of God through a variety of images. He then proceeds to describe in deep and vivid detail the ways in which God operates in our lives as a mother eagle. It is a masterful sermon that stresses the ways in which God's eagle nature is represented of his majesty, and then, continuing in masculine language, insists that people must not confuse the quote-unquote puny kings of the earth with God. Although the masculine language surrounding the pronouns attached to God remained throughout the entire sermon, the admonition against patriarchal idolatry, against patriarchal idolatry is very clearly present. Franklin then goes on to discuss the problem of suffering with reference to God's role as a mother eagle. Franklin points out that the mother eagle makes a nest in high places where she feeds and cares for the baby eagles. However, as they begin to outgrow the nest, she begins to pull the soft feathers out of the nest so that they are less comfortable and want to go out on their own. Such imagery is consistent with his view of human suffering as a way of creating a mature Christian. Finally, Franklin develops indirectly the themes of godly benevolence and providence in his description of the mother eagle's flying lessons for the baby eagles. She takes them out of the nest and drops them and continues to catch them up on her wings. She bears them up on eagle's wings until they finally learn to fly on their own. The sermon is a masterpiece of feminine imagery set in the framework of male discourse. When one hears that sermon, one is able to hear Franklin's glancing references elsewhere in other sermons to the motherly nature of God. In other sermons such as, quote, "The Lord is good," one can experience God as the heavenly keeper of the human nursery. Okay, the preaching tradition is part of the central ritual event, the church service. It is also the most masculine. While more systematic study is necessary, we have to look at these other pillars of tradition to understand the importance of women's experience. I want to talk now about the aspect of women warriors in the prayer tradition. The song, quote, "If I could hear my mother pray again," highlights the centrality of women to the prayer tradition. Most black Christians have been taught to pray by their mothers. The poet Joanne Braxton has stated that her goal in life is to write poetry like her grandmother prayed. Another writer and literary critic remembers the impact of her grandmother's morning prayer on her entire household. Harold Carter, in his reflection on the prayer tradition of black people, cites the importance of women to the vitality and sustenance of the tradition. It is an area of the black experience within which women have never been silent. Thomas Weber, in his study of socialization in the slave quarters community, attributes the deep spirituality of the slaves to their early exposure to prayers for freedom, their mother's and aunt's prayers for freedom. Furthermore, the label prayer warrior is one that runs deep in Black tradition. Again, using the oral history of Mamie Garvin Fields. She relates the story of the events surrounding the purchase of a church from whites by freedmen and women in Charleston, South Carolina, a year after the Civil War ended. She is telling the story she heard growing up in the parsonage of that church. And what happened was, at the end of the Civil War, the whites wouldn't accept payment in paper money. They wanted gold. So these Black folks had to ship in this gold to Charleston, South Carolina, and then the white folks added, because they didn't want to sell the church, that they had to have the gold there by a certain time. And if they were a minute late, they couldn't buy the church, and they'd lose their deposit. And she said, the money had to be to the bank by 12 noon sharp. So a small boat was hired to row out to the ship, which had shipwrecked out in the harbor, to the ship and unload the gold, while the old warriors of the church prayed and prayed for the money to get to the appointed place at the appointed time. The staunchest in the congregation were praying very hard because they had given up the monies that they had buried in cans, savings for their funerals. Anyway, this little boat went out and back, the men rowing for life, as the story goes. When they got back to the wharf, the drayman was waiting with the best horses he could find, and the drayman whipped those horses through the streets of Charleston. All this time, the prayer warriors kept on. When describing the outcome, Mrs. Fields stated simply, the Lord brought us the rest of the way. In the Black tradition, church mothers who have a mighty gift of prayer are called warriors. Men with such gifts are usually deacons. There's research in the Journal of the Scientific Study of Religion that demonstrates that male participation in churches is more dependent on their holding office than female participation in churches. So this is a distinction that's consistent. Thus, when preachers say, quote, some old warrior, the referent is usually to she. In what can only be described as a midrash on Black tradition, Jasper Williams demonstrates the manner and the style of these, quote, old warriors. He stated, they had those old-time covenant meetings. They had those red-hot covenant testifying services. People would get up and talk about how good God had been to them. You'd see some old warrior when time came for her to testify. She'd get up and come down the aisle and lock her arms back behind her back. And she'd cry a while, and then walk a while, and just stand before the altar and say, Reverend, I'm sorry, but it's all over me. It's all in me. It's all under me. And she'd stand there and shout a while. And finally, when she would regain her composure, she'd tell the church, you all remember last month I stood here and asked you to pray for my son. I'm happy to report to you this month that God has heard our prayer. I think that's interesting also because the declaration of God's activity coming out of women's mouths is important. The importance of these women to the church tradition is attested to in Black literature as well. James Baldwin's character praying Mother Washington is such an example. Langston Hughes incorporates the prayer warrior tradition into his novel, Not Without Laughter. The link between Black women and the prayer tradition is a firm one. Rosemary Ruther, in her work, Sexism and God Talk, argues that one of the principal means by which women are subordinated within the religious tradition is through enforced silence. The prayer tradition is a blatant contradiction to this tendency in white denominations. While Paul's admonition to women, quote, to be silent, has been taken literally in the context of European-originated denominations, Black denominations that attempt to take this injunction literally have interpreted this injunction to mean, quote, from the floor. Thus, while Black women may not pray from the pulpit, their, quote, silence speaks loudly in the literary, oral, and preaching traditions of the Black experience. Then I look at one aspect of the music tradition. The music tradition is a paper in and of itself. And we just began to survey the spirituals that refer to women. And just sometimes I feel like a motherless child. It's a classic. But I like to just mention briefly one aspect of the gospel music tradition that's important. One of the most prominent but least discussed aspects of women's visibility within the Black religious experience is the description of God as, quote, a mother to the motherless and a father to the fatherless. It is the music tradition that has carried the most dramatic and well-articulated litanies of deity that reflect both genders. The vehicle by which this description of God became entrenched within Afro-Christian tradition was music. The song, "Surely Our God is Able," written by a man but popularized by women, requires consideration. Popularized by Clara Ward and the Ward Singers, the song was written by the Reverend Herbert Brewster. Tony Heilbutt points out that Brewster believed that, quote, "a gospel song was a sermon set to music. It must have sentiment and doctrine, rhetorical beauty and splendor," end quote. People today should reread Brewster. The singers for whom Brewster wrote were women. As a result, this gospel composer often used inclusive language in his song. In the hit song, "Move On Up a Little Higher," Brewster explicitly states, "all God's sons and daughters will be drinking that old healing water." In Brewster's song, "Surely," the characteristics of God acquire an oxymoronic character in the phrase, "He'll be your mother." As part of an extended chorus to the song, singers sang the following, "Don't you know God is able? He's able. God is able. He's able. Clouds may gather all around you, so dark and sable. He'll be your mother when you're motherless. He's a father when you're fatherless. He's a sister when you're sisterless. He's a brother when you're brotherless. He's a doctor in the sick room. He's a lawyer in the courtroom. When you go down to the Jordan, he will be there to bear your burden. He will step out before you, and my God will know you. Surely, surely, he's able to carry you through." That chorus has been articulated throughout the prayer and the preaching tradition. This phrasing also appears in the testimonies of prayer meetings. Although such examples do not resolve the very real crisis in inclusive language, they remind us of the importance of the gospel music tradition to the imagery Black people share concerning God and other theological subjects. Visions of heaven, understandings of the role of Jesus, and a host of other concerns have been conveyed by gospel music. It is the gospel songs that have also fixed in the oral tradition the importance of such characters as the woman at the well, popularized by the Davis sisters in the song "Jesus Gave Me Water," or "Jesus Met the Woman at the Well." Additionally, the Mary and Martha of the spirituals also survive in the gospel tradition. For some women, gospel singing became an alternative to preaching. It was within this musical movement that some women achieved fame as evangelists. Mother Willie Mae Ford Smith and Shirley Caesar are just two examples of that. Within the music tradition, women are often the principal inciters in the production of religious knowledge. Not only were they singers of men's compositions, they wrote their own. Mahalia Jackson, Roberta Martin, and Mattie Moss Clark are just three names out of any number. Furthermore, two major publishing houses of gospel music were founded and owned by women. Within the annals of gospel musicology, women are cited as agents of style. Women are central to that tradition, and the tradition explicitly includes them in both the production and the product. Finally, I try to look a little bit at the testimony tradition. This joy I have, the testimony tradition. While the importance of the testimony tradition to the process of preaching has already been stated, it is important to examine the testimony tradition with reference to its importance to the Black community itself. The shared nature of the Black religious experience rests upon testimony. The special problems associated with oppression and suffering make the testimony tradition an important vehicle for psychological survival. While the tradition may not resolve Black problems, it is the principal means by which the private troubles of individual Black people become transformed into public issues, the most essential process for the growth of movements for social change. So it's the basic process from which one gets to personal misery to public statement is done in this testimony tradition. Black women are the best testifiers in the community. I borrow that phrase from a woman I interviewed who went to spend a lot of time going to court with children, and she spent so much time going to court, the district attorney said to her, "Haven't I seen you in this court before?" And she said, "Yes, and I told the truth every single time." And she said, "I was one of the best testifiers there was." So that's where I borrowed that phrase from. They carry forward the slave's determination to tell, quote, "God, how you treat me one of these days." Their testimony has been essential for the sense that they can survive, and it is not unreasonable to attribute the low suicide rate of Black women to the role of this shared testimony. One should not be surprised to see the transformation of the testimony tradition into the form of self-help groups, such as Alcoholics Anonymous, and into the form of consciousness-raising groups among contemporary feminists. For women, the testimony tradition can be seen as a form of protest against some of the constraints of being female. Occasionally, one can hear the testimony that goes along these lines. This joy I have, man didn't give it to me. This peace I have, man didn't give it to me. This love I have, man didn't give it to me. Man didn't give it, and man can't take it away, usually said with an edge of determination. The testimony parallels the song made popular by Shirley Caesar, in which the word man is replaced with the word world. Not only do such manipulations of the androcentric nature of the King James text occur, but women will rise up and testify about their struggles as women alone. In any pre-revival devotional session, one can hear a litany of the social problems affecting black women: abandonment, assaults, aging, poverty, and single parenthood, to cite some of the most prominent examples. The testimony tradition may also be responsible for the ideology of sisterhood that abounds among black women. Testimony service or impromptu testimony may serve as an instrument of reconciliation. Again, drawing on this reflection of black church tradition that I quoted earlier by Jasper Williams, he stated, when he, meaning the old preacher, got through, some old mother would get up and say, "Brother Pastor, I'm sorry to cut across you, but I've got to say this. I can't go another further. I've got this grudge I've been carrying around in my heart against Mother Jones, and I can't sleep at night. I can't even pray. And I promised God I wasn't going to leave here until I got things settled. And here we are getting ready to take the Lord's Supper. And I can't eat of my God's body, drink of his blood with what I've got in my heart against Mother Jones." And right there in front of everybody, she'd walk over to Mother Jones and give Mother Jones her hand and say, "Mother Jones, if I have wronged you or hurt you in any fashion, I want you to forgive me. Charge it to my head and not my heart." And some of you know the pathway of that quote in the public oral tradition. Because of the fragmented and fragmenting nature of life in black communities, this potential should not be overlooked. Additionally, where one of the principal problems in women's experience, as defined by the feminist movement, resides in this problem of sisterhood, black women's activity in this tradition represents an important resource. Additionally, the potential for bitterness on the part of some black women is also relieved, while at the same time, that testimony provides an opportunity for understanding the shared nature of their suffering and the legitimate bases for their anger. Finally, I want to talk, my final section is called Some Mother's Son and Some Father's Daughter, The Future of Inclusion. This paper is aimed at highlighting those areas in which gender plays a role in the Afro-Christian tradition. The four pillars of tradition that are shared across denomination and beyond the church settings provide perspectives on the role of women in the shaping of Afro-Christian tradition. The importance of black churches to the survival and organization of black communities would not be possible without the vital roles played by women and their relationship to the social production of religious knowledge. It comes through clearly that both roles and rhetoric contain leitmotifs of inclusion. Black women have been included in the discourse of men while at the same time shaping their own traditions of discourse that are appropriated by the men. In spite of any personal misogyny, and there are a lot of misogynist black preachers out there, don't get me wrong, there are. In spite of any personal misogyny, black preachers want their sermons to connect with the experience of their congregations, and therefore they must make some kind of effort to include black women. One problem that did develop in the 60s that must be addressed is the rhetoric of exclusion that arose within the Black Power movement. Franklin indirectly highlighted and criticized this problem when he complained about members of his church and the community walking around boasting, "I'm a man." His complaint was then followed by the admonition that every Christian should boast about how much of a child of the kingdom he was. In other words, black manhood was not a central concept of Christian community. While the transition from Negro to black was a necessary phase in the history of confrontation between the black community and its white oppressor, and in the confrontation between black people's self-images and the dominant culture's definition of that image, a leitmotif of inclusion was lost in the process. Black women had always felt included in the term Negro. Since one of the important themes of black preaching was the problem of racial oppression, is the problem of racial oppression, the rhetorical switch to the term the black man, at precisely the moment when gender became one of the central issues of American politics, may have had some untoward consequences. Preaching and other forms of male discourse that had been more or less inclusive of women and women's experience became more exclusive. We must recognize the problem with this departure from tradition in order to begin the process of reflection on gender. Pauli Murray, reminding us that the experience of racial oppression has incorporated both Jim Crow and Jane Crow, has offered several cogent criticisms. One of these has centered on the sound of the Black Power movement as a movement for black males to share power with white males. When one listens to her account of the consequences of the Moynihan Report, it is clear that the 1960s brought with it a sense of shame concerning the pivotal role of black women in the politics, economics, and culture of the black community. In light of her criticisms, it is possible to view the Black Power movement as a successful masculinist movement within the black community. In a patriarchy which sought to destroy physically and psychologically all claims of black men to manhood, along with all claims of black women to womanhood, and inclusively of all black people to peoplehood humanity, one can argue that this masculinist emphasis may have been necessary. However, it was and remains necessary to criticize and to oppose a definition of humanity that rests upon, quote, black manhood. In his sermon, The Meaning of Black Power, Franklin addresses this concern. After castigating black power advocates for their violation of Christian ethics in their bid for separatism, he concluded, "If there is any meaning at all to black power, we must know that we are God's children. Proud black men and women, creative, resourceful, productive, working for unity among ourselves with a new sense of political, social, and economic responsibility, we must control our own destiny." When we think back to the evangelical inclusiveness that undergirded the phrase, some mother's son and some father's daughter, one can reflect upon the intergenerational and intergender basis for unity that was advanced by some of the most masculinist, androcentric, and patriarchal black preachers. There exists in the matter of gender in the Afro-Christian tradition a foundation of creative tension. The dynamics of gender organization and of religious discourse in black churches operates to include women and their experience under the umbrella of racial oppression. Although the overall reality of the black church is not egalitarian, it addresses the experience of women and it generates a subliminal level of consciousness that is, and this is an idiosyncratic use of this term, but I couldn't think of anything else, is chiasmic in its approach. The cultural chiasm, some mother's son and some father's daughter, operates to permit a certain degree of intergenerational crossover in consciousness about the issues of racial oppression in the lives of black women and men. Historically, it was mother's sons who wrote the slave narratives and preached the sermons that described the special terrors of, quote, Hagar and her children. At the same time, it was father's daughters who struggled with the problem of lynching and moved to positions of intellectual leadership, to use Du Bois's phrase, in the height of the struggle against Jim and Jane Crow. Additionally, when one notes that the setting for women's discourse concerning men's issues lies outside of the black church's pulpits, and that the retelling of women's terrors lies principally within those pulpits, one is invited to speculate about the nature of the church audience, the absence of men, and the implications of this for the importance of women preachers to the re-inclusion of black men among the laity. That's just a hypothesis. Furthermore, the myth of black female hostility to women preachers, and I use the term myth in its classic sense, that is cultural story. Furthermore, the myth of black female hostility to women preachers becomes intelligible, not excusable, in this chiasmic context. An additional and unstated aspect of the black religious ritual emerges in the form of aging congregations of mothers hearing assurances from their sons that they will carry the memory of tradition forward. There are at some times and under some conditions, this intergenerational and intergender chiasmus closes up in a creative tension that gives rise to miraculous levels of solidarity within the context of the Afro-Christian religious tradition. The civil rights movement is one such example. The slave church needs to be re-examined more thoroughly for hints that it was also such a context. When the central sources of Afro-American religious tradition are examined, the argument that women are outsiders to the social production of knowledge becomes highly problematic. While the black religious experience is clearly patriarchal in most of its expression and is decidedly masculinist in much of its preaching, the cultural maxim, "If it wasn't for the women, you wouldn't have a church," rises up against male attempts to exclude, ignore, trivialize, marginalize, or denigrate lay women in a number of capacities. The biblical scholar Christer Stendahl commented, "I have come to think of heaven as the place where one can discuss one issue at a time." For the black scholar concerned with the problems of society, this is fundamentally true. The problems confronting members of our society cut across lines of race, ethnicity, and gender, to such an extent that we must begin to think pluralistically about the expressions of racial oppression and gender inequity in this society. In the face of such complexity, those of us who study the black religious experience as a vital pillar of social organization in the context of survival, rebellion, and cultural tradition must insist upon a thorough description and explanation of the experience and its organization and interpretation of gender before we begin to restructure, redress, and recast a tradition that has, quote, brought us from a mighty long way. Our souls and hearts, along with our critical and creative minds, must look back and, in the words of Clara Ward, wonder how we got over. Thank you very much.